Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. I'm excited to welcome Emily Stedman, who's a complex commercial litigation attorney at Hush Blackwell in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Emily recently made partner. Congratulations. And in addition to Emily's legal work, she's studied the science behind well-being at Yale and is invested in learning about time management, efficiency, and organization, as well as how these day-to-day struggles can be optimized. That's frankly the main reason I asked Emily to come on, is to talk about all of her interests in sort of the day-to-day practice of being a lawyer. How do I know about Emily? How should you know about Emily? She writes regularly on LinkedIn and X, formerly Twitter, and other places on what it's like to work in big law. And frankly, if you're a junior lawyer or a law student, you should follow her immediately. You will learn a lot. Emily is a graduate of Wake Forest, go Demon Deacons, and the University of Mississippi Law School, where she served as editor-in-chief of the Law Review. Go Rebels. Thanks for being here, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
So I always like to start these conversations by learning about people's decisions to become a lawyer. Sometimes I think about them sort of like our superhero origin stories, just not as cool. So what made you decide to become a lawyer, and what kind of lawyer did you think you were going to be when you got started?
Yeah, so I get this question a lot, and I am a little bit of a stereotype in that both my parents are attorneys. My mom was a first-year law student when I was born after having been a teacher for some time, and my dad was already practicing in-house with an insurance company. And my birth announcement is a joke. Stedman and Stedman welcome their newest associate. So I have been guided, to say it nicely, by my parents towards law school for my whole life. Fifth grade, sixth, seventh grade, I probably would have told you I'm going to be an attorney when I grow up. And I had no clue what that would look like. My mom was in a small firm, family law, and being an administrative law judge, using her education background, and eventually became a juvenile court judge. And my dad eventually became general counsel for this insurance company. So they did very different things. I probably leaned much more towards what my mom was doing, at least on the litigation side, always. Just that's what always sparked my interest. And like a lot of people, I went to law school thinking I would be a prosecutor, a public defender, something in the criminal law or public sector space. And then it changed pretty wildly from there. But that's how I ended up in law school. I did teach for 2 years before law school. I did teach for America. I loved teaching. It was the hardest 2 years of my life, but the most rewarding years of my life. And it was at the end of the Great Recession. I didn't love Phoenix, where I was teaching. And I thought, well, I'll go to law school now. And if I hate it, I'll go back to teaching. I'll move home to Atlanta and teach. And I picked Ole Miss and loved every minute of it. So here we are.
That's awesome. Did you ever feel like your time teaching, even though it was just for those 2 years, sort of affected you when either you were in law school or even today while you're practicing?
Always. I think about teaching a lot. Teaching honed a couple skills that I use every day. Time management. My classroom ran on a very strict schedule. I was always using timers to keep us on track and to move us ahead and make sure we were checking the boxes every day. And then, of course, public speaking. And in big law, you have fewer jury trials than what you might imagine folks having. But if you can talk to a room full of 10-year-olds every day, a jury is honestly not that dissimilar.
I love that. I love that. And at any point, did you feel like you had picked the wrong profession? Like sometimes I get people on the podcast who talk about how they didn't know any lawyers, and they sort of went in with eyes wide open, but a lack of certainty about sort of what it looked like. You had the opposite challenge a little bit, right? Which is like, you knew that lawyers could do lots of things because lawyers in your house did lots of things. Did you ever sort of feel that level of like, maybe I just followed the family business and that was a mistake?
Yes. So that's why I did Teach for America. I grew up in public schools, learned about Teach for America in high school. It really aligns with some of my leanings around public education and giving back. And so when I came to be a senior in college at Wake, I took the LSAT and applied to TFA at the same time. And it was Teach for America was really my out. Like, law school's the fallback, but I'm burnt out on education. I need something different. Teach for America was not taking a break in any sense of the word, but it really gave me time to make sure that if I went to law school, I was going because I wanted to and not because my parents wanted me to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, even for me, I took 2 years off and, you know, my 2 years were a little bit different in that I worked for a year and then I got a master's degree in something else for a year. But I also had that feeling, and I had already taken the LSAT. I also had that feeling of like, now I'm going to law school by choice, not because it's the next natural option. And I will tell you, and everybody who's listening, that I think we graduated roughly around the same time, I think, but the people who are coming into law school now, by and large, are taking time off. We still have K to JD students, but they're a little bit fewer and further between than at least even when I was in school.
I am a big supporter of that. Whenever people ask me if they should go to law school, my answer is almost always, I mean, maybe, but take time off. It can be 6 months to wait tables. It can be being a paralegal, something much more substantive than that, but take time off from school. And I think that helps with a couple things. One, what we've been talking about, making sure you're going to law school for a reason other than it being the only option. And two, it gives you a greater perspective. One, you just appreciate the freedom that comes with being a student. You know, like as a teacher, I couldn't go to the bathroom whenever I wanted to. Like I couldn't go to the grocery store in the middle of the day, things like that. And then I knew what a contract was because I had to sign one to be employed, or I looked at an insurance, you know, package for being employed. And that's not always directly relatable to what you're learning in law school, but it gives you a little bit more real world context for what you're learning.
Totally. And, you know, you mentioned to me when I was preparing questions for this interview that your path perhaps looks linear post law school, but in your words, it was anything linear. So talk to me a little bit about sort of what it was like post graduation, where you thought you'd be and how you ended up where you are.
Yeah. So, I mean, 100%, if you looked at my LinkedIn profile, I went to Wake, great school, did well, got into Teach for America at the height of it being super competitive, like just checking resume boxes, right? Became editor in chief, got my clerkship. But what I tell people a lot is that I feel like my life is a series of second choices. So like Wake was not my first choice for undergrad. UVA was. They waitlisted me. I was bitter. And I said, see ya, like, wait around. Phoenix was not my first choice for Teach for America. Denver was. Ole Miss was not my first choice for law school. Georgia was. Wisconsin was not on the radar for my clerkship. And I think sort of, I guess, to brag a little bit, it's almost uncomfortable to say I have this innate ability to just kind of ride the waves and make the most of wherever I do end up. And over time, with that happening, you really do learn to just jump all in, because a lot of those second choices ended up getting me where I am today.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's amazing to think that we spend so much time figuring out what we want to do, what like the right answer is, capital T. And there's a lot of pieces of this that we have zero control over. And what we do have control over is saying, this is a right choice and I'm going to make the most of it. And it sounds like that's what you tried to do.
Yes. Every time it was really just go in, eyes wide open, make the most of it. And I think for a lot of it, it was, I can just go home to Atlanta if things don't work out. And since 18, I've never been home to Atlanta other than to visit. So it's worked out.
Yeah. So tell me about that. So you are from the South, you went to school in the South, and now you're a big law lawyer in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Talk to me about how that all came about.
Yes. So my mom clerked after law school, and I was probably 5, 6 when she clerked. So I remember her clerking. I remember the judge. We lived near him, coincidentally, and he was a family member. So I always wanted to clerk. I got an internship with a judge for the summer after my 2L year. He was in bankruptcy court. I had never considered being a bankruptcy attorney, but through that internship, I learned a couple things. One, that young attorneys were going into court often, which was something I was looking for to do in my career, get into court. And two, I liked that you could hold the bankruptcy code in your hands. Like, it just felt manageable. It's not straightforward, but manageable. And so early in my 3L year, I applied to clerkships all over the country, and I ended up being hired by a judge in North Carolina, in Raleigh, the chief bankruptcy judge, to be his clerk. This was October, very early October of my 3rd year. And so then I just went about my 3rd year thinking I had this job. And almost a month to the day before I graduated, I got a phone call that judge was no longer going to be a judge. He was to become and still is the dean of Campbell Law School in Raleigh. And remember getting the call distinctly, you know, 10 and a half years later. The judge was gracious, connected me with his network. I started applying rapidly to firms in Raleigh because I'd already signed up to take the North Carolina bar, already rented an apartment in Raleigh. And the judge I had worked for in Jackson, Mississippi, my 2L summer, who I'd essentially been poached from. I declined an interview with him after I took the job in North Carolina, and he was very gracious to me about that. He called me and he said, look, I'm at a judge's conference. I still can't believe what's happened to you. I'm sitting next to this woman whose clerk's about to leave. You should apply when she posts. Yeah. And so this was 2013. So like virtual things were not what they are today. So my dean's office and law school IT connected with the federal courthouse in Milwaukee the day before I graduated for me to interview with her by video. My parents were in town, like went out to lunch with my parents after this interview because graduation was the next day. And I told them I did not want to like her. Like, I've never been to Wisconsin, but if she offers me the job, I'm taking it. And I can't quite remember the timeline, but I started my clerkship a month after graduating because in Wisconsin, they don't have to take the bar. So I had to start immediately. And I moved up here on my 27th birthday and a week later started my clerkship, and I've been here 10 and a half years.
Wow. What I love about those stories is unless you actually like spend some time talking to somebody, you're never going to hear that story. And you're never going to hear about the fact that the job you had your 2L summer by talking to that person and having a conversation that you could not have imagined while you were working for that person, that's what set you up to, frankly, what has become your whole life, yes. Not just your professional life, but your personal life living in Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a big believer in, you know, you're entitled to things or you deserve things. But in my very beginning of the clerkship, my judge told me, Emily, I'm going to apply to be a federal district court judge. And she made a joke like, but don't worry, if I get it, I'll need a clerk. And I had signed up for a 2-year clerkship. At that time, you know, nominations for the federal bench weren't moving quickly. So I just kind of laughed and said, well, that my clerkship will be over by then. Well, she ended up getting the nomination and it was fast tracked. So by December of 2014, she was on the federal bench and I reached out to the judge in Mississippi basically to thank him because I wouldn't have been getting that opportunity. but for the connection. And I did think a little bit like, this is the point of what I went through, you know, trying to justify moving across the country to someplace I'd never been, that I got that district court level clerkship, which truly became the foundation for my career.
Wow. Another great second chance, frankly. Yeah. Talk to me about what that career has looked like since, you know, you said that was the foundation. Where did it go next?
So I guess a little additional context. I was skeptical of big law during law school. When you do well, you're funneled through there. I had an off and on blog in law school that was a holdover from teaching, and I had posted that I was skeptical. And one firm in Jackson, Mississippi did not interview me because of that blog. And the person who told me that, I laughed and said, well, like, shouldn't we be skeptical? Like, this is a big commitment. So clerking in one way, similar to teaching, was a way for me to have more time to figure out what it would look like. I enjoyed the bankruptcy court time. I enjoyed the district court time. The best thing about clerking is getting to know the court. Those are relationships I still have today. And at my first firm, which was then an Am Law 200, but I think now is also Am Law 100 firm here in Milwaukee, I did both some creditors' rights bankruptcy work and general commercial litigation. And that's always what I have favored, is if I can be in federal court, particularly the Eastern District of Wisconsin, but any federal court, that's where I'm most comfortable. Just knowing the rules, knowing the judges, it has been an extreme benefit throughout my career.
And say more about sort of what you do and what you like to do on a day-to-day basis, because I think you're absolutely right. Like, people get funneled into big law. It happened to me. It's happened to many other people. And I think it often works out well, not always, but people who are getting funneled don't always have a sense of like, is that they're going to be doing. And so I'd be curious to hear sort of your day-to-day life is like, and also what are the things you like most about it?
Yeah. So I do love it. I've been in a big firm for going on 7.5 years. So it's all I've known. For all but 1 year of that, I have been happy and satisfied professionally. I think the benefits of big law are the machine, the assistants, the paralegals, the support staff, the business people that can help your practice run smoothly and efficiently. And there's always someone, an attorney or business professional, who has an answer for you. Particularly with assistants and often paralegals who have been doing this much longer than you have. Just a wealth of information. On the other hand, even in the Midwest, some of the stereotypes are very real, like super high expectations, lots of hours. Yes, my billable requirement is lower than, you know, the biggest firm in town or the East Coast, New York City firms, but it's still a lot of hard work and high pressure. And that can be exacerbated by the type of people that big law attracts. So achievers, people who haven't always or often struggled with things, like a lot has come easy to them. On the day-to-day, you know, the hardest thing for me is that no 2 days are the same. So that took a lot of getting used to. Now I can write it out, and I've learned tools along the way to help me figure that out. But especially in the beginning, you're doing a lot as a litigator. You're doing a lot of one-off research projects, which are nice in the beginning because that's a comfort zone for law students. Writing memos, reviewing documents, and doing discovery. So reviewing discovery requests, responding to discovery requests, drafting discovery requests, and reviewing documents before you produce them. It's a huge chunk of what we do, in addition to writing briefs, taking and preparing for depositions and defending depositions.
And of those tasks, right, you know, one of the things that I like to talk to people who are sort of at your level is how you learn to do all of them, right? You sort of hinted that it was a little uncomfortable to do things that are new to you. And how did you learn how to do all of these tasks? And how could you leverage your prior experience? How do you think about that?
Yes. So clerking is almost exclusively research and writing. So on that front, I felt pretty comfortable. You're also reading a ton of briefs as a clerk. And the best thing about clerking, I think, is learning what not to do. You learn very quickly what is not effective oral or written advocacy. And that's always served me well, as well as what annoys judges and their law clerks. On the flip side, discovery was not anything I'd ever done. I was very fortunate at my first firm to have two senior associates who let me ask all my, what I thought were stupid questions, I now know are very, very normal and common questions. I remember one, he had me shadow depositions and prepare discovery responses, and he had no qualms with me just like literally looking over his shoulder and watching how he sent an email, how he used the document system at that firm. Another one took on more of like an overt mentor role, being just real honest with me about who is worthwhile to work with, who's not. And he was someone that I knew was the gold standard at the firm. So if I had to write a brief that I'd never written before, I would look in the system to see if he'd ever written a brief, and I would 100% copy it. Because you know this, that law students are hammered on plagiarism, and rightfully so. You need to learn how to think on your own. But in a law firm, plagiarism is like flattery, right? Like never start from scratch.
Yes.
So I'm just constantly in the system looking for the partner or senior associate I'm working with, samples that they've done, particularly that have been filed in court. So I know that's the final version that I can learn from.
And do you think that part, you know, I also had that experience of having sort of people both a little bit ahead of me and a lot ahead of me sort of letting me, either letting me watch them do it or me being able to watch them do it without them knowing by looking at their old documents. Do you think that's getting harder as we move to a more remote or hybrid first environment, and especially at firms where people are all over the place geographically?
Yes, in the sense that even just personally, it's often difficult for me to remember to include the first year associate on call calendar invites. But know in that I'm often almost always able to remember to include them on emails. And it is such an email driven practice that I will tell the associate when I onboard them, I will just copy you on email so you see what this looks like requests to the library, requests to my assistant. So they start seeing those examples in the real world. I think we've settled away from this a little bit, but in the beginning of the pandemic and when we started return to work, there was this big hullabaloo about mentoring not face-to-face. Well, I'm an elder millennial and I'm 37. I have been chatting with my friends digitally since middle school. So this isn't new for me. I've been maintaining virtual and digital relationships, you know, for 20 years. So I think it is easier than maybe older Gen Xers and boomers anticipated.
That's a really thoughtful point because, yeah, we're in the same sort of general generation. And you're absolutely right. Like I had friends that I kept in touch with where our primary mode of communication was remote long before we had the word remote as a way of talking about things. That's a really thoughtful point. It does require a little more work, I think, on the part of everybody to be more intentional, just like it does in our personal lives.
Yes. And I've just been fortunate to have landed at a new firm, not new anymore, but I joined Hush Blackwell in November of 2020. So very much still on lockdown. I was not allowed to come into the office in the beginning. And everyone was very intentional and like super intentional from the top down. Hush Blackwell, which I think has made it able to distinguish itself in these last 3 years because of the intentionality around remote work and relationship building.
So you also talked about being on the billable hour, and I want to make sure we talk about that because you're very public about being on the billable hour. But before we do, I guess I would be curious if you have any particularly memorable cases or experiences from sort of the last 8 or so years of practice that you'd be willing to share to sort of give us an even more complete picture of what it's like to be you and be do the kind of law that you do?
Sure. So, I mean, I think everyone always remembers their first deposition. Mine was in a financial services litigation case. I did represent a mortgage company or loan servicer, which I know will give some people the heebie-jeebies, but I had to depose the borrower, and it was just such a memorable experience. It was on the western side of Wisconsin. It was snowing when I was over there, which also made it memorable. And it wasn't combative, like it was a traditional fact-finding mission, and the witness was generally compliant, I will say cooperative, but that really immediately and substantively confirmed that I love depositions. I love, if you think about it as just talking to someone, it's just really fun. You get to really dive into the facts to prepare. You get to ask them questions and just learn. And if I could just take depositions all the time, I would. So my first deposition, very memorable.
Wait, let's talk depositions for a second. So I had no idea when I graduated law school what a deposition was or what it looked like in federal court. And then I also got thrown into that early in my career. So I'd love, can you just describe sort of to someone who's never done or been part of a deposition, what that looks like and sort of what the prep is on the front end to make that happen?
Sure. So the closest analogy is it's like an interrogation, but it's also for a fact witness, it's a conversation. So where I like to start is with the documents and with the elements of the claim. So breach of contract, I want to have the contract. I want to identify what the breaches are, try to dig in a little on what the damages are, what the evidence the other side has of their damages. Because a lot of times there may have been a breach, but there are no damages, right? That can be a defense. So up front, you're reviewing all the documents and then you create an outline. Most outlines always start with the general, like, who I am, asking the witness to confirm who they are, going through some background, what led to the dispute, confirming the dispute that we're there to discuss. And I tend to have document-driven, as I've referred to that multiple times already, document-driven depositions. So you lay the foundation for the document, put the document in front of the witness, talk to them about the document. It's not like TV in that there's, you know, not usually a big aha or I gotcha moment, but you can learn a lot about how the other side views their case. You know, you can notice where they're getting defensive. The other thing is there's a transcript being made, a written transcript. And the best advice I got for depositions was that pauses don't show up in a deposition transcript. So I will often have a 30-second to a minute pause either on purpose to maybe see if the witness will fill in the blank or to collect myself, to catch up on my outline, see where I am. And that, I think, allows you to stay in control and kind of maintain your composure along the way. And then there's defending depositions where you do basically the same prep, but you don't do the talking. You're defending your witness and objecting to the other side's questions.
Right. I love the concept of like it's like a conversation, except you have a bunch of documents that you've prepared with that witness may or may not have seen more recently than you have. And it lasts for 7 hours, at least in the federal system. And yeah, I think the pause thing is really thoughtful and smart. And it's something I never thought about. Have you ever read a deposition transcript back and sort of like put your hands on your head, like, I can't believe I asked that question or said it that way?
Yeah, so I hate reading them back, but they're almost always never as bad as you think they were, is almost always better than you anticipate. Other good advice I got was that first deposition, I sent it to a couple people and had them read it and give me advice back. There's also trainings you can do where you record yourself on video. I hate that. But that's where I realized in depositions, if I have a swivel chair, I will sway back and forth. And had I not videoed myself, I would have never known that. I also can't have clicky pins, and I rely on and so to kick off questions. Like when I get going and I've got a bunch of follow-up questions, I'll say and so. Videoing can help too.
Absolutely. Well, and if you ever want to practice figuring out what your verbal fillers that you can always go on podcasts mm-hmm. or start your own, and then you really learn everything you say. So yeah, I think I may have cut you off on your other story, but I want to talk billable hour. So you're very, very public, probably the most public person I've seen on social media about what it's like to live on the billable hour. And obviously to many people who are listening to this, particularly people who have lived on the billable hour for a long time, this will not be news to them, but it's not something we talk about. So I'd love to hear sort of your thoughts on both working on a billable hour, but also how you think about tracking it and both letting it run your professional life, but not letting it run your whole life.
No one taught me how to track it. So my first year or two, I would get to the end of my associate year and have to scramble to meet my hours goal. And I didn't like that feeling because always had enough work to end up meeting my goal. But why should I bill 200, 250 hours those last 2 months of the year if I can be more intentional about it? And I can't remember how I found her, and I'm going to forget her name. Her first name's Heather. She had a podcast, and I must have just found her through law-driven podcasts. And she was the first attorney-turned-coach that I'd ever come across. And she laid out this billable hour calculation where you take your year and you break it into monthly goals. And at the start of each month, you break it into daily goals that you can then calibrate every day and every week as you meet or miss your goal. And I was like, this is brilliant. And at my old firm, we got a lot of data around the billable hour, but not any breakdown kind of like that. My current firm does it to a degree, but it needs to be individualized, right? Because of what I have going on in my life, if there's technically 21 business days in December, maybe I'm going on vacation, maybe I'm going to a conference, maybe I've got a dentist appointment. So I'm not always going to be billing full days just because it's a business day. And by breaking it into monthly, weekly, and daily goals, I can account for that. So I'll start each month with that monthly goal. Like I'm at 1900 divided by 12 is like 160 something, I think. Someone's going to correct me on that math and it's going to be closer to 170. And I then look at my calendar and I see how many days I'll work a full day, how many days I'll work a half day, days that I'm not on the office, in the office. Maybe I have a pro bono clinic on a Saturday and that counts. And I'll make a daily goal based on that. And if I get to the end of the week and I've exceeded my goal, I'll take those hours off of Monday or a little bit off of each day in the next week. And that just helps me feel like I'm in control of the billable hour rather than it controlling me. Now, I get several pushbacks on the billable hour. One, people hate it. I get that. Rightfully so. It's used as a badge of productivity. It's used to give associates raises and bonuses without a lot of consideration to the quality of the hour. Or if you're in a niche practice group that just does lower work, but at a higher dollar or hourly rate, you know, I think that should be considered in your raise and bonus, but not every firm agrees with that. On the other hand, the question becomes, what if you don't have enough work? And that is valid. You will reach a point in your career where you don't have to worry about that. But there are always slow times. And what I tell people is you can knock on doors, you can send out emails, you can ask for more work. You can also hone your skills, develop a personal brand, read articles, write articles, network. Anything, and I then track all that time and enter it into our system so the firm sees that I'm not twiddling my thumbs. Like, maybe my billable hours are down, but you can see all these other hours that don't count towards that base requirement, but show I'm invested in my career or in the firm.
First of all, that's makes what seems like a tough conversation about like being on the billable hour sound very reasonable. And I think I'm glad you highlighted the sort of fears, two of which I was going to bring up, right? One is like fear of not having enough work. And the other is sort of, aren't you just saying, oh, this is the great way to do things, even though it's not necessarily, certainly not the only way to do things. You know, I think one other critique that I hear about the billable hour and thought about when I was in practice was that you end up spending so much of your time tracking like little minutiae that at the end of the day, a lot gets lost. Like you end up doing work and thinking that doesn't get captured. And at the same time, you probably capture things that frankly, if you didn't have to capture them, you might not have captured them. So talk to me a little bit about how you think about that dance.
So I am writing down everything I do all day, every day. And I think the biggest hindrance for people living under the billable hour is that they don't create a habit and system early on that works for them. And it has to be personalized. What works for me may not work for you and vice versa, but you have to get in a habit of entering your time and tracking what you're doing all day, every day. And it's not intuitive. It can feel crazy, but if you keep at it, it becomes second nature. And so are there times where I start writing down my time and I spend a point to, you know, 12 minutes doing something and I don't end up billing for it? Yes, but I'm still writing it down. And I think this fear of overbilling is a lot less common. What I hear from partners is people are underbilling. And one thing that really helped me, and I just told an associate who reached out on LinkedIn to do this, is ask a partner for a copy of the bill for a matter that you're working on that went out to the client. See how partners are billing their time. Because you'll notice you're doing similar tasks, but they may describe it differently. It may take them less time. It may take them more time. And it'll just give you a greater frame of reference for what's actually going out to the client, which gives you perspective about what you're entering and how you're entering it each day.
Yeah, I think that's really, really smart. I don't think I ever looked at a bill in my several years as an associate, and I lived under the billable hour.
I didn't until recently. So
yeah, that's really helpful. And every firm does it differently, and every partner does it differently, and every client does it differently. So, but it sounds to me like your ultimate advice is, it's actually less stressful if you sort of have a whole picture of it. And the other piece of advice is make a habit of tracking. Did I miss anything there?
No, I think that's spot on. And the one thing I'll add is that associates that I see come in and they have this fear of disappointing people. So they want to write off their time, or they're concerned about like, will this partner think I spent too long? And the hardest part about entering a big firm, I think really probably any legal job after law school, is you lose grades. You lose a regular cadence of formal feedback that looks like grades or what you're used to. So you have to adopt the mentality of no news is good news. If it wasn't going well, if you weren't billing properly, if you're billing too much, someone will tell you, because that affects their bottom line. That affects what's going to the client. Otherwise, no news is good news. And if you're getting more work, if they read your memo and have a follow-up question, those are the subtle things of feedback that can calm that sort of, at least for me, incessant fear of I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I think that's such a huge mindset shift when you go into practice from being in school. And that doesn't go away. I mean, even today, I mean, I feel like that when I wish I had a professor that I could turn my articles into before I had to turn them into law journals, because you have this lack of certainty, because you're right, you cut off that feedback loop. So building in as many feedback loops and understanding that no news is good news, I think is awesome advice.
Yeah. And I just, on that note, it doesn't go away. Like if you lean towards anxiousness the way I do, like I found out I made partner, and within 4 weeks of that, at least once, I questioned whether they were going to change their mind, like whether they were going to take it back. So like some of that, just because we're high achievers, those doubts just never go away. And honestly, what my therapist has helped me see is that just shows that I care. That comes from an internal driver of wanting to do a good job, wanting to be successful. And so you have to learn to kind of control it if you can, or tell it to be quiet, but it doesn't go away for a lot of us.
Well, I'm excited that you made partner. I was excited when I saw on LinkedIn, even though this is our first time meeting digitally. Talk to me a little bit about that process, if you don't mind, not sort of the nitty gritty of the process, but sort of how you went from thinking I'm a really good associate to here's what I need to do to sort of take the next step in the law firm hierarchy.
Yes. So when I joined a firm in 2013, there really was one path: make partner or leave your firm. That's not the case anymore. Most big firms have some alternative attorney role that's a non-partner track. I mentioned earlier that for all but 1 year, I've been very content in this job. During that year of discontent, I was really struggling. And I thought, I don't know if I'm cut out for this. I don't know if this is what I want. Do I want to be partner? And I was fortunate to have people both personally and professionally who I could turn to and really talk to about that. So for my husband, for example, he was able to say to me, it's not the law that you're unhappy with, it's your current circumstances or area of work. So I wanted to get away from the bankruptcy work, for example, and just focus on commercial lit. When I joined Hush Blackwell, I connected with who is now my formal mentor, and we're very similar in sort of just being candid. And I was able to say to him, is making partner worth it? Because I love being a senior associate. You finally hit this cusp of having some autonomy, having some decision-making authority, getting to take the really interesting depositions, not just being in the nitty-gritty of discovery, but sort of running e-discovery, which I enjoy. And why would I give that up, right? So I did have to think about it. And my mentor told me it was worth it. A friend of mine, who I'm still very close with from my old firm, made partner. He describes it as being worth it. And so a year ago, I was hopeful that this 2023 would be my last year as an associate. And I just kind of set out to make sure there was no reason for my firm not to make me partner. And that can look different for a lot of people. At my firm, it looks different across practice group, across industry team. But for me as a litigator, it looked like meeting my billable hour requirement, getting clients to pay my hourly rate or close to it for most of those hours, and getting some credit. So you'll hear people talk about credit. There's all different kinds. All firms use different names. I took the role of managing credit. So I got credit for running the day-to-day logistics on files, and that helped me make the case for partnership. It wasn't easy. I definitely had doubts, but the day I found out is not a day I'll forget. It's right up there with the day I found out I passed the bar. Getting to call my parents and, you know, join them on a conference call and tell them I made partner, highlight of my year, you know, probably of my career to date, other than my first and second jury trials, probably. So I'm very grateful and optimistic and ready for this next level, and we'll see how it goes.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations again. And I'm looking forward to seeing the next level. And then maybe you can come back, assuming How I Lawyer exists in a few years, and you'll tell me what it's like to be in the first few years of partnership and how things are changing. So we're getting close to the end of our conversation. I just want to touch on one or two more things that you talk about publicly and do publicly. One is that you're very active on social media, particularly on LinkedIn, and that's how we found each other. And I guess I'm curious sort of why you started doing that. And to somebody who's listening to this and thinking, like, she sounds like she works a lot, she sounds like she has a lot going on, like, what is she writing and why is she writing and why would anybody read it? Like, what are your thoughts on being on social media like that?
So I have dabbled in this as a millennial off and on since like the internet came to existence and never really found my niche. And as I was looking to change firms, I took a class on leveraging LinkedIn and I optimized my profile and started following people in the law. So Jay Harrington is the first one that comes to mind.
Former podcast guest Jay Harrington as
well. A wonderful resource, former big law and small firm owner, founder. And I saw what he was doing and I thought, this might scratch that creative writing itch that I've been thinking about. And I, at the same time, was becoming more and more vocal and involved in the lawyer well-being space. And I just started posting. Honestly, it was like reposting Jay's stuff, posting an interesting article. But when I would talk about two things, lawyer well-being and real life in big law, I immediately got the most engagement. And at first, it was not overt engagement on my posts. It was direct messages. It was bringing it up when I saw people in real life. But that was all the motivation I needed to keep at it. And I think I use LinkedIn like a blog. I talk about lawyer well-being. I talk about real life as an associate. It'll be interesting to see how that shifts as I transition into partner. And I think what makes it successful is I'm candid and vulnerable and honest. And LinkedIn then also gives professional guardrails that I don't, you know, skew too far in one way or the other. I also would be remiss to say, or not to include, that my firm has been extremely supportive, which I did not anticipate and I don't take for granted.
And in terms of actually finding time and space to do it and doing it in a way that is authentic to you, obviously, you sort of hinted that at the end about your firm being supportive of it, because I know some firms are, frankly, less supportive of it. How do you think about that and fitting it into your professional life?
It's a lot less time than people think. It's 30 minutes to an hour in the morning if I'm actually writing a post from fresh, which those are my posts that do the best, are the off-the-cuff ones. I might have a topic in mind, but then I just write it in the morning. I try to spend time engaging with other people and with people who comment on my posts. Then throughout the day, I just check it like when I'm walking to the bathroom, when I'm in the elevator, like sort of those one-off times that we're all taking, I'm on LinkedIn during that time. So it's a lot less time than people think. And then going back to the idea of habit creation, I've been doing it for almost 3 years now, so it's become second nature, but I'm always telling people it's a lot less time than you think.
And do you think it's, I mean, I know for me, it's helped me. Do you think it's helped you both personally and professionally to be out there in that format?
100%. So hasn't necessarily gotten me any business, but I'm stretching and growing the business development muscle. I'm getting opportunities like this. So I'm practicing talking about what I do, getting my name out there. I also think as a litigator, it has helped me with my legal writing. I'm able to just write more clearly and more succinct and like I talk, because I'm practicing that almost every day on LinkedIn.
Love it. Love it. All right. Two last questions. So one is about lawyer well-being, and I didn't mean to save it till the end, but talk to me a little bit about what you mean by that and sort of how, what role it plays in your life.
So in our prep email that you sent, you mentioned that lawyer well-being can be kind of a trite phrase. And I think it can be used that way, like work-life balance. If anyone out there has a different name, I'm all ears for it. But what I really mean by lawyer well-being, I guess, is just taking care of yourself and not letting yourself go because the profession is demanding. And I have that tendency. I'm speaking from experience. I feel like I have legitimacy to talk about it because I'm in the grind doing it every day alongside the people that I'm speaking to on LinkedIn. And we just need to know we're not alone. Like, this job is hard. Most of us struggle. Most of us have doubts. Most of us worry that we're disappointing someone. And if we just talk about that more and talk openly about the help we're getting, we are going to make the profession better. And all the statistics, all the studies show that attorneys struggle. We self-identify with higher levels of depression, anxiety, substance use, and abuse. And we just need to destigmatize it. And so when I say lawyer well-being, I just mean taking care of ourselves as attorneys, but then also bringing some humanity to the job, like recognizing that we're all humans.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And I think the more we talk about it, the better. And frankly, the more candid we are about our own lives and telling our own stories. I mean, that's, as you know, one of my driving forces is I think the more we hear about people's stories, the good parts, the bad parts, the parts that don't show up on social media, the parts that do, the better off the profession will be.
100%.
All right. So final question, which is for a piece of advice, and you've given a bunch from how to take a deposition to how to keep your time to lawyer well-being. So I'll let you choose the topic, but what's something that you wish you knew when you were just graduating or just getting started in the profession that you'd share with somebody who's just getting started now?
It is okay to be yourself. So I think during my clerkship, during my first year, year and a half in a big firm, I was trying to be Alicia Florrick from The Good Wife or, you know, some of the associates you see on Suits, like be this stereotype because that's the only real example I had. I went to a CLE for female litigators and this woman said, if you can't be yourself at your firm, you need to go until you find where you can. And that just opened the door for me to consider, am I being myself? Can I be myself? And you can. Like you can. And we lie to ourselves by telling us we have to fit this profile, this image, and that'll protect us to a degree, but it won't satisfy us. And you will not be satisfied in your career until you bring your whole self to it. And I'll give you permission. If no one else is giving you permission, I give you permission to start bringing your unique and whole self to what you're doing every day.
Amen. Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, look, Emily, I'm so grateful we got to do this. Well, we'll have to find a reason to do a live episode someday in Milwaukee so we can connect in person. But this has been really awesome. And keep writing. Where can people find you? Because you're one of my favorite follows. So where can people find you?
So if you Google me, Emily Stedman at Hush Blackwell, my firm profile will come up. There you can find links to Twitter/X and LinkedIn. Those are the places where I am most active.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Emily, and best of luck. And once again, congratulations on the new adventure that will be partnership.
Thank you.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening and have a great week.